On the Life of Moses I have resolved to write the life of Moses, whom some call the lawgiver of the Jews, others the interpreter of sacred laws, a man in every way the greatest and most perfect, and to make him known to those who deserve not to be ignorant of him. For while the fame of the laws he left behind has traveled through the whole inhabited world and reached even the ends of the earth, not many know who he truly was in the truth of the matter, perhaps out of envy, and also because in many cases the lawgivers appointed by the various cities were unwilling, out of opposition, to consider him worthy of mention among the sayings honored by the Greeks. Most of these lawgivers abused the powers they gained through education, composing in both poetry and prose comedies and tales of sybaritic licentiousness, a notorious disgrace, when they ought instead to have put their natural gifts to use in setting forth good men and good lives, so that nothing noble, whether ancient or new, capable of shining forth, might be abandoned to obscurity through neglect, and so that, by passing over the better subjects, they might not seem to prefer, in their eagerness, those unworthy of a hearing, merely in order to make evil things appear splendid, and thereby put reproaches on display. But I, for my part, shall pass over their malice and set forth the facts concerning this man, having learned them both from the sacred books, which he left behind as wondrous monuments of his own wisdom, and from certain elders of the nation. For I always wove together what was said with what I read, and for this reason I believe I have achieved a more exact account of his life than others. I will begin from the point at which it is necessary to begin. Moses was Chaldean by descent, but he was born and raised in Egypt, because his ancestors, on account of a long famine that oppressed Babylon and the surrounding region, had migrated with their whole household to Egypt in search of food, a land level and deep-soiled and most fertile in everything that human nature requires, and especially in the fruit of grain. For the river of that land, at the height of summer, when the other rivers, both the winter torrents and those fed from native springs, are said to shrink, rises and overflows, flooding and turning the fields into marshland. And these fields, needing no rain, supply every year an abundance of every good thing, unless the wrath of God should at some point intervene on account of the prevailing impiety of the inhabitants. He was allotted a father and mother who were the best of their contemporaries, people whom likeness of mind united to one another even more than kinship, for they belonged to the same tribe. He was the seventh generation from the man who, though himself a newcomer, became the founder of the whole nation of the Jews. He was thought worthy of royal nurture for the following reason. The king of the country, since the nation kept increasing in numbers, grew afraid that the settlers, becoming more numerous, might contend with the native population, by force of a stronger hand, for supremacy of rule. And he schemed with unholy devices to sap their strength, ordering that the female infants born to them be reared. Since a woman, through the weakness of her nature, is reluctant for war, but that the males be destroyed, so that they might not increase throughout the cities. For a population strong in fighting men is a stronghold hard to capture and hard to overthrow. So then, when the child was born, he at once displayed a countenance more refined than that of an ordinary person, so that his parents, so far as they were able, disregarded the tyrant's proclamations. At any rate, they say he was nursed at home on milk for 3 consecutive months, without the knowledge of most people. But when, as tends to happen under monarchies, some began searching into private matters, always eager to bring some new report to the king, the parents, fearing that in seeking the safety of one child they, being many, might perish along with him, tearfully exposed the child by the banks of the river and went away groaning, lamenting their own compulsion and calling themselves murderers and child killers with their own hands, and lamenting also the child's utterly unreasonable destruction. Then, as is natural in so strange a situation, they accused themselves of being the cause of an even greater calamity. Why, they said, did we not expose him the moment he was born? A child who has not yet had a share of gentle nourishment, most people do not even consider a human being. But we, in our excess, reared him a full 3 months, providing more abundant grief for ourselves, and, for him, providing punishment, so that, being able to partake to the fullest of both pleasures and pains, he might perish with a keener sense of harsher evils. And so they went away, gripped by pitiable grief in ignorance of what was to come, but the sister of the exposed infant, still a young girl, moved by family affection, watched from a little distance to see what would happen. All this, it seems to me, came about through the providence of God, who was taking care of the child. The king of the country had a beloved and only daughter. It is said that, though married for a long time, she had not conceived children, though she desired them, as was natural, and especially a male child, who would inherit the fortunate lot of his father's rule, which was in danger of being left without grandsons. And she, being in the habit of remaining at home and never crossing the threshold, was moved by the weight of her cares to set out one day with her handmaids to the river, where the child lay exposed. And then, intending to use the baths and lustral waters, she caught sight of him in the thickest part of the marsh and ordered him brought to her. Then, surveying him from head to foot, she was struck by his beauty and vigor, and, seeing him in tears, she pitied him, her soul already turning toward maternal affection as though toward her own true child. But recognizing that he was one of the Hebrews, since they feared the king's decree, she began deliberating about his upbringing, for she thought it was not yet safe to bring him at once into the palace. While she was still in perplexity, the child's sister, as though from a watchtower divining her hesitation, ran up and asked whether she wished the child to be nursed on milk by one of the Hebrew women, one who had not long before given birth. When she said she wished it, the girl brought forward her own mother, and the infants, as though she were a stranger, and the mother, gladly and all the more readily, promised to nurse him under the pretext of payment, by the design of God, who was thereby providing the child's first, genuine nourishment. Then she gave him the name Moses, fittingly, because she had drawn him out of the water, for the Egyptians call water Mu. But when, growing by leaps and increases beyond the ordinary course of time, he was weaned rather quickly, his mother, who was at once both mother and nurse, brought him back to the one who had given him to her, since he no longer needed to be nursed on milk, so that he might be seen as noble and refined. And when she saw him, now more fully grown, and drew even more affection from his appearance than before, she made him her son, having first arranged matters concerning the appearance of pregnancy, so that he might be thought her true child and not a substitute. For God makes everything easy that he wishes, even things hard to accomplish. Being now thought worthy of royal nurture and attendance, he did not, like an ordinary infant, delight in mockery, laughter, and childish games, even though those entrusted with his care allowed him freedom and showed nothing severe toward him. Instead, displaying modesty and dignity, he attended to what he heard and saw, insofar as it would benefit his soul. Teachers at once came to him from various places, some from the neighboring regions and the districts of Egypt, coming of their own accord, others summoned from Greece with great rewards. In no long time he surpassed their abilities, through the excellence of his nature, outstripping their instructions, so that it seemed to be recollection rather than learning, and he even devised for himself solutions to what was difficult to perceive. For great natures innovate much in the realm of knowledge. And just as bodies in good condition, with all their parts agile, free their trainers from concern, since they require little or no attention, and as farmers are freed by trees of good growth and noble stock which improve of themselves, in the same way a well-endowed soul, anticipating what is said, is helped more by itself than by its teachers. And once it has grasped some starting point of knowledge, rushes forward, as the proverb says, like a horse into the open field. As for numbers and geometry, and the theory of rhythm and harmony and meter, and music in its entirety, through the use of instruments and the accounts given in the arts and their applications, the learned men among the Egyptians instructed him in these. And further, in the philosophy conveyed through symbols, which they display in what are called the sacred writings, and through the veneration of animals, which they even honor with divine honors. While the rest of general education the Greeks taught him, and those from the neighboring regions taught him the Assyrian script and the Chaldean science of the heavens. This science of mathematics he also acquired from the Egyptians, who cultivate it most especially. And having accurately learned, from both parties, the points on which they agree and disagree, he set aside contentiousness and sought the truth without love of strife, since his mind could not admit any falsehood. Unlike those who fight over mere opinions, who support whatever doctrines happen to be set before them without examining whether they are sound, doing the same thing as those who plead for pay and give no thought at all to justice. And now, passing beyond the bounds of childhood, he intensified his self-mastery, not, like some, allowing his youthful desires to run unbridled, even though they had countless incitements from the lavish provisions that royal courts supply, but restraining their forward rush by force, as though with reins, by means of self-control and endurance. And each of the other passions too, though by nature raging and rabid, he tamed and gentled. But if ever it stirred even slightly and fluttered, he administered heavier chastisements than mere verbal reproof. And in general, he watched over the soul's first impulses and onsets as one watches an unbroken horse, fearing lest, outrunning reason, whose duty is to hold the reins, they throw everything into confusion. For these are the causes both of good things and of bad. Good, whenever they obey reason as their leader, the opposite, whenever they run loose into anarchy. As was to be expected then, both his companions and everyone else were astonished, struck as if by some strange spectacle, and asked themselves what kind of mind dwelt within him and was carried about like a statue in his body, whether human or divine or a mixture of both, since he had nothing resembling the many, but rose above them and was lifted up toward something greater. To his belly, he allotted nothing beyond the necessary tribute that nature has appointed, and of the pleasures below the belly, he gave no thought at all, except so far as was needed for begetting legitimate children. Having become, beyond all others, a devoted practitioner of contentment with little, and having mocked the life of soft luxury as no one else had, for he longed to live by soul alone, not by body, he displayed the doctrines of philosophy through his daily deeds, saying what he thought and doing what accorded with what he said, so as to bring speech and life into harmony, that his speech might be examined as being such as his life, and his life such as his speech, sounding together as on a musical instrument. Most people, if but a slight breath of some good fortune falls upon them, puff themselves up and breathe great things, and in their arrogance call those less conspicuous than themselves refuse, nuisances, and burdens on the earth, and other such names, as if they had sealed the unshaken permanence of their prosperity securely to themselves, though they will perhaps not remain in the same state even until the next day. For nothing is less stable than fortune, which tosses human affairs up and down like pieces on a board, often in a single day casting down the exalted and raising the lowly on high. And though they see this happening always, and know it clearly, still they look down on their own kin and friends, transgress the laws under which they were born and raised, and set in motion their ancestral customs, customs deserving of no just blame having become dissolute, and through their acceptance of the present, take no further thought for anything of the past. But he, having already reached the very summit of human good fortune, considered the grandson of so great a king, and being, in everyone's expectation, all but the successor to his grandfather's realm, indeed, what else was he but the one addressed as the young king? Nevertheless, emulated the education proper to his own kin and ancestors, holding that the good things of those who had adopted him, however more brilliant for the moment, were spurious, while those of his parents by nature, even if for a while less conspicuous, were at any rate his own and genuine. And like an incorruptible judge between those who had begotten him and those who had adopted him, he repaid the one with goodwill and ardent love, the other with gratitude for the benefits received, and would have gone on repaying them to the end, had he not observed a great and unprecedented act of impiety newly perpetrated in the land by the king. For the Jews were strangers, as I said before, since the leaders of the nation had migrated from Babylon and the upper satrapies into Egypt because of famine and lack of food, and had in a sense come as suppliants fleeing to an inviolable sanctuary, seeking both the king's good faith and the mercy of its inhabitants. "Let strangers," he said, "be registered before me as judge as suppliants of their hosts, and resident aliens as being both suppliants and friends, hastening toward equal honor with citizens and already neighbors to them, differing but little from the native-born. These, then, who had left their own homeland and come to Egypt to dwell securely as in a second fatherland, the ruler of the country enslaved, and as though he had taken them captive by right of war, or bought them from masters to whom they were house-born slaves, subjugated and made slaves, not merely the free, but even strangers, suppliants, and resident aliens. Neither respecting nor fearing the god of freedom, of hospitality, of suppliants, and of the hearth, who is overseer of such things. Then he imposed commands heavier than their strength could bear, piling one labor upon another, and the lash followed close upon those who cried off from weakness. For he chose as overseers of the works the most pitiless and savage men, who granted no one any pardon, men whom, from what befell under them, people called taskmasters, exod. 3:7. Some labored shaping clay into brick, others gathering straw from every quarter, for straw is the binding of brick, while others were assigned to the building of houses, walls, and cities, and to the cutting of canals, themselves hauling timber by day and by night without relief, having no rest, not even being allowed so much as to lie down and sleep. Forced to do the work both of skilled craftsmen and of laborers, their bodies gave out within a short time, since their souls too had already collapsed beforehand. Some, indeed, died one after another as if from some pestilential ravage, and these they threw out unburied beyond the borders, not even allowing kinsmen or friends to heap earth over the bodies or to weep for those so pitiably destroyed. But the impious men threatened with mastery even the unenslavable passions of the soul, the only things that nature has released free from virtually everything else, oppressing them with a more powerful weight of necessity, unbearable to endure. Over these things he continued in grief and distress, being unable either to punish the wrongdoers or to help the wronged. But what he could do, he did by word, exhorting those set over the work to moderate themselves and relax and slacken the severity of their commands, and urging the laborers to bear present hardships nobly, to be men in their resolve, and not to let their souls grow weary along with their bodies, but to expect good things out of evil. For everything in the cosmos changes into its opposite: clouds into clear sky, violent winds into still air, the surge of the sea into calm and stillness, and human affairs even more so, inasmuch as they are still less stable. With such incantations, like a good physician, he thought to lighten their sufferings, heavy as they were. But whenever these eased, they attacked again in turn, bringing with them, out of that brief respite, some new evil always harsher than what came before. For among those set in authority were some exceedingly untamed and rabid men, no different in savagery from venomous, flesh-devouring beasts, wild animals in human shape, who put forward the form of their bodies as a pretense of gentleness, for the purpose of hunting and deceit. More unyielding than iron and adamant, one of these, the most violent of them, when far from giving way, he only grew the more savage at appeals made to him, would strike those who did not perform what was commanded without pause and with quick hands, abuse them to the point of death, inflict every kind of outrage upon them, and kill them, deeming the deed a pious one. And pious it was held to be, that a man living for others' destruction should himself perish. When the king heard this, he grew indignant, considering it a terrible thing, not that someone had died, or had killed either justly or unjustly, but that his grandson did not think as he did, nor held the same people as friends and enemies, but hated those whom he himself loved, and loved and pitied those toward whom he himself was immovable and implacable. Once they had seized this opening, the men in power, who already eyed the young man with suspicion, for they knew he would remember their impious deeds against him and take vengeance when opportunity offered, poured countless slanders into his grandfather's open ears, some from one side, some from another, so as to instill fear even about the loss of his throne, saying, "He will attack. He thinks nothing small. He is always contriving something further. He desires kingship before his time. He flatters some, threatens others, kills without trial, and has put forward as his favorites those most loyal to you. Why do you delay, instead of cutting short what he intends to do? Great is the advantage delay gives to those who plot, against those who are the object of the plot." As they went on speaking such things, he withdrew into neighboring Arabia, where it was safe to stay, at the same time entreating God to deliver the innocent from their desperate misfortunes, and to punish as they deserved those who had left nothing undone in their outrages, and to grant him to witness both of these things, doubling the favor. And God heeded his prayers, admiring his love of the good and hatred of evil, and before long, as befits a god, gave judgment on the affairs of that land. And while judgment was still pending, Moses kept contending in the contests of virtue, having within himself as his trainer a noble reasoning, by which, exercised toward the best of lives, both the contemplative and the practical, he labored on, ever unrolling the doctrines of philosophy, discerning them readily with his soul and storing them in memory so as never to forget them, and at once fitting his own actions to them, all of them praiseworthy, aiming not at seeming but at truth. Because he had set before himself one single goal, the right reason of nature, which alone is the source and spring of the virtues. Now another man, fleeing the implacable anger of a king, and having just arrived for the first time in a foreign land, not yet familiar with the customs of the natives nor precisely knowing what pleased or displeased them, would either have been eager, by keeping quiet, to live more obscurely, escaping the notice of the many, or, if wishing to come forward into public view, would at least have sought to win over by assiduous attentions the powerful and those of greatest influence, from whom some benefit and help might be expected, should anyone come and try to drag him off by force. But he drove along the path contrary to what was to be expected, following the healthy impulses of his soul and allowing none of them to be tripped up. Wherefore, sometimes he even played the bold youth beyond his actual power, holding justice to be an invincible power, by which impelled, self-summoned, he rushed to the aid of the weaker. I will also tell what he did at that time, small though it might appear, yet not the product of a small mind. The Arabs raise cattle and pasture their flocks, not only the men, but the women too, both young girls and virgins among them, and this not only among the neglected and undistinguished, but also among the highly eminent. Seven girls, daughters of a priestly father, were leading their flock and had come to a certain spring, drawing water with buckets tied to ropes, taking turns from one another so as to share the labor equally. They were filling, with great eagerness, the troughs that lay nearby. But other shepherds arrived, and looking down on the girls' weakness, tried to drive them off along with their flock, while bringing up their own animals to the water that had been made ready, intending to reap the fruit of another's labor. Seeing what was happening, for he was not far off, Moses ran at full speed, and standing close by said, "Will you not stop your wrongdoing, thinking that solitude gives you license for greed? Are you not ashamed, keeping your arms and forearms idle? You are thick hair and flesh, not men. The girls act with youthful vigor, shrinking from none of the tasks that need doing, while you young men already live in luxury like girls. Will you not go on your way? Will you not withdraw before those who came first, to whom the water belongs? Having drawn it out for them so that the water might be more abundant, is it right that you now hasten to take away what has been made ready? But know, by the heavenly eye of justice, which looks even into the most desolate places, you shall not take it away. I, at any rate, have been appointed their champion, though unlooked for I am an ally to those who suffer wrong, with a great hand which it is not lawful for the greedy to see. You will perceive it, though unseen, wounding you, unless you change your ways." As he spoke these things, for even as he spoke he seemed inspired, transformed into a prophet, they grew afraid that he might be uttering oracles and pronouncements, and became obedient. And they led the virgins' flock to the troughs, having first moved their own animals aside. The girls returned home greatly rejoicing, and recounted what had happened, beyond their hopes, so that they roused in their father a great longing to meet the stranger. Indeed, he reproached them for their ingratitude, saying such things as this: "What has come over you, that you let him go, when you ought to have brought him at once, and even if he held back, to have pressed him? Or have you judged me guilty of some hatred of humankind? Or do you not expect to fall in with wrongdoers a second time? Those who forget favors are bound to be at a loss for helpers when they need them. But even now, for the fault is still curable, hurry back and invite him, first to be our guest, and then also to share in some return of thanks, for gratitude is owed to him." Hastening back, they found him not far from the spring, and having made known their father's wishes, they persuaded him to come home. And the father, struck with amazement first by his appearance, and a little later by his purpose, for great natures are conspicuous and are not recognized only after a long time, gave him the fairest of his daughters as wife, bearing witness by this one act to all the qualities that make for nobility of character, and to the truth that only what is beautiful is worthy of love, needing no recommendation from another, but carrying its own credentials within itself. After the marriage, he took charge of the flocks and pastured them, being trained in advance for leadership. For shepherding is a rehearsal and preliminary exercise in kingship for one who is going to govern the gentlest of all flocks, mankind, just as hunting trains natures suited for war. For those who are being prepared for military command practice beforehand in the chase, the irrational animals being set before them as a kind of raw material for the exercise of authority in either season, that of war and that of peace. For the hunting of wild animals is a general's exercise against enemies, while the care and oversight of tame ones is a king's contest with his subjects. And this is why kings are called shepherds of the peoples, not as a reproach, but as a supreme honor. And it seems to me, examining the matter not by the opinions of the many, but by the truth, let whoever wishes laugh, that only the man who is skilled in the science of shepherding could become a perfect king, having been trained in lesser creatures for the government of the greater. For it is impossible for great things to be brought to completion before small ones. Having become the best of the herdsmen of his time, and, through never shirking any task, but employing a willing and self-directed eagerness wherever the oversight of the flocks required it, together with a pure and guileless fidelity, capable of supplying all that contributed to the animal's benefit, he made his flocks increase, so much so that he was already envied by the other herdsmen, who saw nothing comparable in their own flocks, for which it seemed good fortune merely to remain as they were. Whereas for his, failure to improve daily would have counted as a loss, so accustomed had they become to receiving great increases in beauty from good flesh and fatness, and in number from prolific breeding and healthy conditions of life. Leading his flock to a place well-watered and rich in pasture, where it happened that much grass suitable for grazing sheep grew abundantly, he came near a certain wooded ravine and saw a most astonishing sight. There was a thorn bush, a plant altogether weak and thorny. This, though no one had brought fire to it, suddenly burst into flame, and though wholly enveloped from root to branch tip in a great blaze, as though from some fountain pouring it forth, it remained unharmed, not consumed, as if it were some substance immune to suffering and not itself the fuel of the fire, but rather using the fire as its own nourishment. In the midst of the flame, there was a form of surpassing beauty, unlike anything visible, a most godlike image, flashing forth a light more radiant than fire one might have suspected it to be an image of being itself. Let it be called an angel, since it announced, almost in words, through the stillness of a voice clearer than any sound, the things that were about to come to pass by means of the vision that had been wrought. For the burning thornbush was a symbol of those who suffer wrong, and the blazing fire a symbol of those who do the wrong, while the fact that what was burning was not consumed signified that those who suffer injustice would not be destroyed by their assailants, but that the attack of the one side would prove ineffective and unprofitable, and the scheme of the other would go unpunished. And the angel signified the providence of God, which in great stillness brings ease to what is most terrifying, beyond all human expectation. The thornbush, as has been said, is a plant most weak, yet not without its thorns, so that if one merely touches it, it wounds. And it was neither consumed by the fire, which by nature devours, but on the contrary was protected by it, and remaining just as it was before it caught flame, having lost nothing whatever, it gained in addition a radiance of light. All this is a kind of sketch of the condition of the nation, which prevailed at that time, all but crying aloud to those in distress. Do not lose heart, your weakness is your strength, which will prick and wound countless foes. By those who long to destroy your race utterly, you will, against their will, be preserved rather than perish. You will not be harmed by their evils, but precisely when someone thinks to ravage you most, then above all you will shine forth into glory. Again, the fire, a destructive substance, was refuting those of savage temper. Do not be lifted up by your own strength, seeing irresistible powers brought low, be brought to your senses. The burning power of the flame is consumed as though it were mere wood, while wood, which by nature can be burned, plainly burns like fire. Having shown this marvel and wonder to Moses as the clearest exhortation of things soon to be accomplished, God begins, through his pronouncements, to urge him on to hasten his care for the nation, declaring that he would soon become not only the agent of its freedom, but also the leader of its migration from that place, and promising to assist in everything. For they have long been mistreated, he says, and have endured outrages hard to bear, with no human being lightening or pitying their misfortunes. I myself have taken pity on them. For I know each one individually, and I know that all of them, turning together with one accord to supplication and entreaty, hope for help from me, and I am by nature gentle and merciful to genuine suppliants. Go then to the king of the country, with no fear whatsoever, for the former king has died, the one from whom you fled for fear of his plot, and another has been entrusted with the country, who bears you no grudge for anything that has happened, and, taking with you the elders of the nation, tell him that the nation has been summoned by me through an oracle, so that it may go out, according to its ancestral custom, a 3 days' journey beyond the borders of the country, to offer sacrifice. But he, well aware that both his own kinsmen and everyone else would disbelieve what he said, replied, "If then, they ask what is the name of the one who sent me, and I myself am not able to say, will I not seem to be deceiving them?" And he said, "Tell them first that I am he who is, so that, learning the difference between what exists and what does not exist, they may also be further taught that no name at all can properly be used of me, to whom alone being belongs." He said, "Tell them first that I am the one who is, so that, learning the difference between what is and what is not, they may be further taught that no name at all properly belongs to me, to whom alone being belongs. But if they are weaker in nature and seek an appellation, make known to them not only this, that I am God, but also that I am the God of three men named for virtue, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob, of whom one is the standard of learned wisdom, another of natural wisdom, and the third of practiced wisdom. And if they still disbelieve, they will be won over by three signs, taught by things which no one has ever before seen or heard of among men." The signs were of this kind. He bids him throw the rod he was carrying down onto the ground. It immediately came to life, crept along, and, most commanding of footless creatures, became a serpent of enormous size, utterly perfect. Quickly withdrawing from the creature and now rushing to flee out of fear, he is called back, and at God's command and with courage instilled in him at the same time, he seizes it by the tail. The serpent, still writhing at the touch, stood still, and stretching itself out lengthwise, was immediately changed back into the very same staff, so that both transformations caused amazement, and one could not judge which was the more astonishing, the soul being struck by an equally balanced impression. This, then, was the first sign. A second was worked not long after. He commands him to hide one of his hands in his bosom and bring it out again a little later. When he did as commanded, the hand suddenly appeared whiter than snow. But when he put it back into his bosom and brought it out again, it returned to its own color, recovering its natural appearance. These things, then, he was taught by God alone, alone as a disciple by a teacher, having with him the instruments of the wonders, the hand and the staff, with which he had been equipped beforehand. A third sign could not be carried with him or taught beforehand, but was destined to astonish no less, and it took its beginning in Egypt. It was of this kind. "Whatever river water," he says, "you draw and pour out on the ground will become blood, the reddest of blood, changed in color and in substance into a complete alteration." This too, it seems, appeared credible, not only because of the truthfulness of the one speaking, but also because of the wonders already displayed beforehand with the hand and the staff. Yet believing, he nonetheless tried to decline the commission, saying that he was slow of speech and slow of tongue, and not eloquent, especially now that he had heard God himself speaking. For judging human eloquence, by comparison with the divine, to be speechlessness, and being at the same time cautious by nature, he shrank from things too great for him, judging matters of such magnitude not to be within his own capacity, and he begged that another be chosen who would be able to carry out easily each of the tasks assigned. But God, accepting his modesty, said, "Do you not know who gave man a mouth, and fashioned his tongue and windpipe and the whole instrumentality of articulate speech? It is I fear nothing, then, for at my nod everything will be jointed together and will change to what is fitting, so that nothing will any longer hinder the stream of words from flowing smoothly and evenly from a pure spring. But if there is need of an interpreter, you will have your brother as a subordinate mouth, so that he may report to the multitude what comes from you, and you may report to him the things of God." Having heard this, for it was not altogether safe or free from danger to keep objecting, he set out, and journeyed with his wife and children on the road to Egypt. And on the way, meeting his brother, he persuaded him to accompany him by telling him the divine oracles. And indeed his brother's soul had already been prepared beforehand by God's forethought for obedience, so that he agreed without hesitation and followed readily. Arriving in Egypt with one mind and one soul, they first gathered the elders of the nation together in secret and disclosed the oracles, and how God, taking pity and compassion on them, promised to grant them freedom and a migration from there to a better country, declaring that he himself would be the guide of the journey. After this, they now boldly conversed also with the king about sending the people beyond the borders to perform sacred rites, saying that it was necessary for the ancestral sacrifices to be carried out in the desert, not performed in the same manner as those of other peoples, but in a way and by a law that escaped commonality because of the special peculiarities of their customs. But he, his soul oppressed from swaddling clothes by ancestral arrogance, and believing there was no intelligible God at all beyond the visible ones, answered insolently, saying, "Who is this whom I must obey? I do not know this so-called new Lord. I will not send the nation away on the pretext of a festival and sacrifices to run wild." Cf. Exodus 5, 2. Then, being harsh and heavy in wrath and implacable in anger, he commands that those set over the works be abused, as granting relaxation and leisure, saying that it belongs to relaxation and leisure to deliberate about sacrifices and festivals. For those under compulsion do not even remember such things, but only those whose life is spent in great comfort and luxury. So then, as they endured heavier misfortunes than before, and grew indignant at Moses and his companions as deceivers, reviling them, some secretly and some openly, and charging them with impiety for seeming to have lied falsely about God, Moses begins to display the wonders he had been taught beforehand, thinking that those who witnessed them would change from the disbelief that possessed them to belief in what had been said. The demonstration of the wonders took place before the king and the Egyptian officials as well, with great eagerness. So when all the powerful men had flocked together into the palace, Moses' brother took the staff, and shaking it very demonstratively, threw it down onto the ground. It immediately became a serpent, and those standing around watched, and, filled with astonishment, withdrew in fear and fled. But as many sophists and magicians as were present said, "Why are you so astounded? We too are not unpracticed in such things, but we employ a craft that produces the like." Then, each throwing down the staff he held, there was a multitude of serpents, and they coiled around the first one. But that one, rising up to a great height far beyond the rest, widened its chest, and, opening its mouth, with a most violent rush of drawing breath, gathered them all in as in a fisherman's net cast around a shoal of fish, drew them in, swallowed them, and then changed back into the original nature of a staff. By now the spectacle wrought on so grand a scale had exposed the suspicion lurking in the soul of each of those willfully doing wrong, so that they no longer thought what was happening to be the sophistries and crafts of men, fabricated for deception, but rather that a more divine power was the cause of these things, for which all is easy to accomplish. But when, though compelled to admit as much by the manifest clarity of what had occurred, they were nonetheless no less emboldened, clinging to the same inhumanity and impiety as though to some most secure good, neither pitying those unjustly enslaved, nor doing what was commanded through words. Since he who had made his will clear through the more distinct proofs of oracles worked by signs and wonders now, had need of a heavier threat and a swarm of blows, by which the senseless are admonished. Those whom reason did not educate. 10 punishments are brought upon the land, a perfect number of chastisement against those who had sinned perfectly, and the punishment was unlike customary ones. For the elements of the universe, earth, water, air, and fire, are set upon them, God having judged it just that the land of the impious should be destroyed by the very things out of which the world was completed, as a demonstration of the power of the rule he wields, the same elements which he shapes and turns, whenever he wishes, toward salvation for the generation of the universe, and toward destruction for the ruin of the impious. He distributes the punishments, the ones from the coarser elements, earth and water, from which the bodily qualities were completed, he entrusts to Moses' brother as priest, the equal number from air and fire, the elements most productive of soul, to Moses alone. One, common to both, the seventh, he assigns to them jointly. And the remaining three, to complete the number 10, he reserves for himself. And he begins by bringing first the plagues from water. For since the Egyptians had honored water above all else, believing it to be the origin of the generation of the universe, he thought it right to summon this element first, for the rebuke and admonition of those who revered it. What then happened not long after? At the divine command, Moses' brother brought the staff down upon the river, and at once, from Ethiopia all the way to the sea, it turned to blood. And along with it, the lakes, canals, springs, wells, and fountains all turned to blood together, the entire body of water throughout Egypt, so that for lack of anything to drink, people had to hold back from the water at the banks, while the opened veins, as in cases of hemorrhage, shot forth streams of blood like pipes, with not a single clear trickle to be seen anywhere. And the whole race of fish died too, since the life-giving power had turned destructive, so that a foul stench filled everything throughout, so many bodies decaying all at once. And a great crowd of people, destroyed by thirst, lay in heaps at the crossroads, since their kin had no strength left to carry the dead out to the tombs. For 7 days the calamity held its grip, until the Egyptians begged Moses and his companions, and these in turn begged God, to take pity on those who were perishing. And God, relenting in his nature, changed the blood into drinkable water, giving the river back its ancient streams, pure and life-giving. But no sooner had they been granted a brief respite than they rushed back into the same cruelty and lawlessness, as though justice had vanished from the world entirely, or as though those who had already endured one punishment were not liable to a second chastisement. But by suffering they were taught, like young children, not to be contemptuous, for the punishment that follows close on their heels was slow to catch those who merely intended wrong, but overtook at a run those who were running toward wrongdoing. For again, Moses' brother, at God's command, stretched out his rod over the canals, pools, and marshes and brought on the plague. At the stretching out of the rod, so vast a multitude of frogs crept up that not only the marketplaces and every open space, but also the farmsteads, houses, and temples, every private and public place, were filled with them, as if nature had decided to send out one whole species of water creatures as a colony into the opposite land, for dry land is the opposite of water. So the people could neither go outdoors, since the streets were already occupied, nor stay indoors, for the frogs had already taken over the inner rooms as well, crawling up even to the highest points, and they were in the dire straits, having despaired of any deliverance. So again they took refuge in entreaties, the king promising to permit the Hebrews' departure, while they won God over with supplications. And when he consented, some of the frogs withdrew into the river, while others died on the spot, and there were heaps of them piled up at the crossroads. People even carried out their own dead from their homes because of the unbearable stench that rose from the corpses of creatures which, even while alive, had produced great disgust to the senses. But having gained a brief respite from the punishment, like athletes in a contest gathering their strength so as to commit wrong with more robust vigor, they ran back again to their habitual wickedness, forgetting the evils they had just endured. God, having withheld the punishments from the water, now brought on those from the earth, appointing the same man as its instrument. And he, again at the command given, struck the ground with his staff, and a swarm of gnats poured out and, spreading like a cloud, covered the whole of Egypt. Though the creature is very tiny, it is nonetheless most troublesome, for it does not merely damage the surface of the skin, causing unpleasant and most harmful itching, but also forces its way inside through the nostrils and ears. And flying into the pupils of the eyes, it does damage there too, unless one is on guard. But what guard could there be against so great a swarm, especially when God is inflicting the punishment? Perhaps someone might ask why he punished the Egyptians by means of creatures so insignificant and disregarded, passing over bears and lions and leopards and the other kinds of untamed beasts that prey on human flesh, or if not these, at least the Egyptian asps, whose bites are naturally lethal without delay. But if he really does not know, let him learn. First, that God wished to admonish the inhabitants of the land rather than to destroy them, for had he wished to wipe them out entirely, he would not have used animals as allies, so to speak, for his assaults, but rather the God-sent scourges of famine and plague. After this, let him also be taught a further lesson, necessary for the whole of life. What is it? When human beings go to war, they seek out the most powerful ally to reinforce their weakness. But God, being the highest and greatest power, has need of nothing. Yet if he chooses to use certain things as instruments of punishment, he does not select the strongest and greatest, caring nothing at all for their might. But by fitting out cheap and tiny creatures with invincible and unconquerable powers, he wards off wrongdoers through them, as indeed now. For what is cheaper than a gnat? Yet it had such force that all Egypt was compelled to give up and cry out, "This is the finger of God," Exodus 8:19. For not even the whole inhabited world from end to end could withstand that hand, much less the whole cosmos. Such, then, were the punishments worked through Moses' brother. But we must next examine, in due order, those which Moses himself administered, and from which parts of nature they were composed. Air and heaven, the purest portions of the substance of the universe, take up after water and earth the task of admonishing Egypt, a province over which Moses was appointed steward. He began first by disturbing the air. For Egypt alone, almost uniquely among the countries lying in the southern climate, does not receive one of the yearly seasons, namely winter perhaps, as the account goes, because it is not far from the scorched zone, the fiery element flowing invisibly from there and warming everything around it. Or perhaps because the river, flooding at the summer solstice, uses up the cloud formations beforehand, for it begins to rise at the start of summer and subsides as summer ends, at which time the Etesian winds also come rushing down against the mouths of the Nile. Through these, still prevented from pouring out, since the sea, raised to a height by the force of the winds, extends its triple waves like a long wall, the river is held back within. And then, as the streams collide, the one coming down from the springs above and the one that ought to flow out to sea being turned back by the obstruction and unable to spread wide. For the banks on either side squeeze it in. It rises, as one would expect, and mounts up. Or perhaps also because it was needless for winter to occur in Egypt at all. For that for which rainfall is useful, the river also supplies, flooding the fields for the yearly production of crops. But nature does nothing in vain, so as to furnish rain to land that has no need of it. And at the same time she delights in the manifold and diverse harmony of her works of skill, having fitted the concord of the whole together out of opposites. And for this reason she supplies to some the benefit of water from above, out of heaven, and to others from below, out of springs and rivers. So then, with the country thus disposed, its winter behaving like spring, the regions near the sea moistened only by scant sprinklings, while those above Memphis, the royal seat of Egypt, receive no snow at all, the air suddenly turned so revolutionary that everything which, in harsh winters, falls all at once elsewhere befell it together. Downpours of rain, hail heavy and abundant, the violence of winds colliding and clashing against one another, the bursting of clouds, unceasing flashes of lightning and peals of thunder, continuous thunderbolts which produced a most monstrous spectacle. For running through the hail, a substance at war with fire, they neither melted it nor were quenched by it, but remained unchanged, coursing up and down and preserving the hail intact. But it was not only the extraordinary abundance of everything that drove the inhabitants to excessive despair, but also the strangeness of the event. For they supposed, as was indeed the case, that what had happened was a novel work wrought from divine wrath, the air having turned revolutionary as never before, to the ruin and destruction of trees and crops, together with which no small number of animals also perished, some by the cold, others crushed as if stoned by the weight of the falling hail, others consumed by fire, and some remained half-burnt, bearing the marks of wounds from the thunderbolts as a warning to those who saw them. When the disaster abated, and once again the king and his court grew bold, Moses stretched out his rod toward the sky, at God's command. Then a wind came rushing down, a most violent south wind, growing in force and intensity throughout the whole day and night itself on its own, a great affliction. For it is a dry wind, causing headaches and dullness of hearing, and capable of producing nausea and distress, especially in Egypt, which lies toward the south, the region through which the light-bearing stars make their circuits, so that as soon as the wind is stirred up, the blaze driven from the sun travels with it and burns everything. But together with it, there also came an irresistible multitude of creatures destructive to plants' locusts, which, pouring out ceaselessly like a stream and filling the whole air, devoured whatever the thunderbolts and the hail had left, so that nothing green was any longer to be seen growing anywhere in that vast land. Then at last, coming to a most exact realization of their own situation, the leading men, overwhelmed by the disasters, went to the king and said, "How long will you refuse to let the men go? Or do you still not learn from what is happening that Egypt is ruined?" And he agreed to all that seemed necessary, once the calamity had let up. But when Moses prayed again, a wind rising from the sea scattered the locusts. And when they had been scattered, and the king was still in his death throes over releasing the nation, a greater evil than the earlier ones came upon them. For though it was a bright day, darkness suddenly poured over everything. Perhaps an eclipse of the sun more complete than those usually seen, or perhaps because the continuous, unbroken density and the most violent compression of the clouds cut off the passage of the rays. So that day was indistinguishable from night, and indeed a single night was reckoned as long as 3 days and as many nights together. Then, they say, some lay flung on their beds and did not dare to rise, while others, whenever some natural need pressed them, groped along the walls or whatever else was near, like the blind, and made their way forward with difficulty. For the light of the fire needed for daily use was in some places put out by the storm that held sway, and in other places obscured and rendered invisible by the depth of the darkness, so that the most essential of the senses, sight, though sound in itself, was rendered blind, unable to see anything, and the other senses were also turned aside, like subjects obedient to their ruling sense once it had fallen. For no one could bear to speak or to listen or to take food, but they wasted away in silence and hunger, giving leisure to none of their senses, but wholly seized by their suffering. Until Moses, again taking pity, entreated God, and God brought about light instead of darkness and day instead of night, together with a great clearness of sky. They say the blows worked by Moses alone were of this same kind, the one of hail and thunderbolts, the one of the locust, and the one of darkness, which admitted no form of light at all. But there was one plague the two brothers were jointly commissioned to bring, which I will now describe. At God's command they took ashes from a furnace in their hands, which Moses scattered little by little into the air. Then a sudden cloud of dust, falling upon both human beings and irrational animals, produced a savage and agonizing ulceration over the whole surface of the skin, and their bodies at once broke out in eruptions, swelling with festering blisters, which one might have guessed were secretly boiling up from beneath. Racked by pains and agonies, as was natural from the ulceration and inflammation, they suffered in soul no less than in body, and were worn out with distress. For one would have seen a single continuous sore stretching from head to foot, all the separate wounds on the various limbs and parts having merged into one and the same form. Until, once more through the lawgiver's supplications on behalf of the sufferers, the disease grew milder. This chastisement, fittingly, the two of them were commissioned to bring jointly, the brother because of the dust that was cast up, since the care of what happens from the earth had fallen to his lot, Moses because of the air, which changed for the affliction of the inhabitants, for he was the minister of the blows that came from air and heaven. Three punishments remain, wrought by God's own hand alone, without any human agency. I will describe each of them as best I can. The first came through a creature the boldest of all in nature, the dogfly, which those who first assigned names, for they were wise, called by its true name, compounding it from the two most shameless of creatures, the fly and the dog, the boldest of land animals and of winged ones respectively. For these creatures come and rush upon one fearlessly, and even if one tries to drive them off, they contend to the last against being beaten back, until they have gorged themselves on blood and flesh. The dogfly, having taken on the daring of both, is a biting and treacherous creature, for it darts from far off with a whirring sound like an arrow shot, and falling violently upon its target, fastens itself in deep. But at that time, the assault was also driven by God, so that the malice it worked was doubled, no longer relying only on its natural advantages, but also on those from divine contrivance, which armed the creature and roused it to force against the inhabitants of the land. After the dogfly, there followed another punishment, again without human collaboration, the death of the livestock. Herds of cattle, flocks of goats and sheep, and every kind of beast of burden and other animal perished in droves all on a single day, as though at one signal, foreshadowing the destruction of human beings that was soon to come, just as happens in plague epidemics. For it is said that the sudden death of dumb animals is often a forerunner of epidemic illness. After this came the tenth and final judgment, surpassing all that went before. The death of the Egyptians, not of all of them. For God did not intend to lay the land waste, but only to give warning, nor of most of the men and women together of every age. But letting the rest live, he passed sentence of death on the firstborn alone, beginning with the eldest of the king's children and ending with that of the meanest slave girl at the mill. For around midnight, those who had first called others father and mother, and had first in turn been called sons by them, all healthy and sound of body, were suddenly cut down in the prime of life for no apparent cause, and they say that no household was left without a share in the calamity at that hour. At daybreak, as was natural, each family, on seeing their dearest ones unexpectedly dead, those with whom they had shared their home and table until evening, were seized by the heaviest grief and filled everything with wailing, so that, because the suffering was common to all, when everyone cried out together with one voice, a single lament resounded from one end of the land to the other. And as long as people stayed within their houses, each, ignorant of his neighbor's misfortune, grieved only over his own. But once he went out and learned of the other's losses, he immediately took on a double grief in addition to his own, the shared grief now weighing heavier and harder than the lesser, lighter one he had felt before, since he was also robbed of any hope of consolation. For who was going to comfort another while himself in need of the same comfort? And, as is usual in such circumstances, thinking that what had happened was only the beginning of worse to come, and fearing for the destruction of those still living, they ran together to the palace in tears, their garments torn, and cried out against the king as the cause of all the calamities that had befallen them. For they said, if at the very outset when Moses had made his request, he had let the nation go, none of what had happened would have been experienced at all. But since he had yielded to his customary stubbornness, he had reaped, ready-made, the wages of his ill-timed contentiousness. Then one urged another to drive the people out of the whole land with all speed, counting even the delay of a single day, or rather a single hour, as grounds for irreparable punishment. Those who were being driven out and expelled, coming to a recognition of their own noble birth, ventured a bold act, such as was natural for free people not forgetful of the wrongs unjustly plotted against them. For, carrying off much spoil, they loaded some of it upon themselves and put the rest upon their beasts of burden, not out of greed for money, or, as an accuser might say, out of desire for what belonged to others, far from it. But first as recovering the wages owed them of necessity for all the time they had served, and second as requiting, in lesser and unequal measure, what they had suffered in their enslavement. For where is there any equivalence between the loss of money and the deprivation of freedom, for which those who have sense are willing not only to give up their possessions, but even to die? In both respects, then, they were in the right, whether one takes it that they were receiving wages, as in peacetime, of which they had long been unjustly deprived by those unwilling to pay them, or that they were, as in war, taking the property of enemies by the law of the victors. For the Egyptians had begun with unjust deeds, enslaving strangers and suppliants, as I said before, in the manner of captives, while the Hebrews, when the opportunity arose, defended themselves without recourse to arms, with justice itself as their shield and the hand that upheld them. With so many blows and punishments was Egypt chastised, and not one of them touched the Hebrews, even though they lived together in the very same cities, villages, and houses, when earth, water, air, and fire, the very elements of nature, which it is impossible to escape, were turned against the land. And this was the most paradoxical thing of all, that by the same agents, in the same place, and at the same time, some were destroyed while others were kept safe. The river turned to blood, but not for the Hebrews, for whenever they wished to draw water, it changed back to drinkable water for them. The frog crept up out of the waters onto dry land and filled the marketplaces, farmyards, and houses, but it withdrew only from the houses of the Hebrews, as though it knew how to distinguish who deserved punishment and who did not. No gnats, no dogfly, no locust, which did great damage to plants, crops, animals, and human beings, came flying against them. No continuous downpours of rain, hail, or thunderbolts reached as far as them. Of the most agonizing ulceration, they felt not even a trace, not even in a dream. While the deepest darkness was poured out upon everyone else, they passed their time in clear light, the daylight shining upon them. While the firstborn among the Egyptians were being taken, not a single Hebrew died. Nor was this surprising, since even the destruction of countless livestock had not carried off a single herd belonging to them. And it seems to me that anyone who had been present at what happened at that time would have thought the Hebrews nothing other than spectators of the sufferings that others were enduring. And not only that, but that they were being taught the finest and most beneficial of all lessons, piety. For never before had the judgment between good and evil come so plainly into view, bringing destruction to some and deliverance to others. Of those who went out and migrated, the men of military age numbered above 600,000, while the rest of the throng, old men, children, women, was not easy to count. There went out with them also a mixed crowd of stragglers and servants, like a mass of the illegitimate mingled with the genuine multitude. These were the children born to Egyptian women by Hebrew fathers and reckoned into their paternal line, together with all who had come over as converts out of admiration for the piety of the men, and any others who, by the magnitude and repetition of the successive punishments, had been brought to their senses and had changed their ways. Over all these Moses was appointed leader, receiving his rule and kingship not as some do who force their way to power by arms and engines of war, with forces of cavalry, infantry, and fleets, but for the sake of his virtue and nobility of character and the goodwill toward all which he had always shown without fail, and further because God, who loves virtue and loves what is noble, bestowed on him this worthy prize. For when he left behind his rule in Egypt, being grandson of the king then reigning, bidding a hearty farewell, because of the wrongs being done in the land, to the hopes those who had adopted him had placed in him, on account of the nobility of his soul, the greatness of his purpose, and his natural hatred of wickedness, it seemed good to him who governs and cares for the universe to repay him with the kingship of a more numerous and greater nation, one destined, above all others, to serve as priest, forever offering prayers on behalf of the whole human race, for the averting of evils, and for a share in blessings. On taking up his rule, he did not, as some do, strive to increase his own household and advance his sons, for he had two to great power, so as to make them, for the present, his partners and later his successors. For in guileless and pure judgment, applied to all matters small and great alike, he mastered his natural affection for his children, like a good judge unmoved by bribes in his reasoning. There was one goal that lay before him, an absolutely necessary one, to benefit his subjects and to labor by deed and by word for their advantage, letting no opportunity pass that might contribute to the common good. Alone among all who have ever governed, he did not treasure up gold or silver, did not collect tribute, acquired no houses, no estates, no livestock, no household service, no revenues, nothing else conducive to luxury and abundance, and yet he could have had a superabundance of everything. Instead, holding that it is the mark of a soul's poverty to embrace wealth that consists in material things, he honored the man of blind wealth as a fool, but esteemed the one who sees the wealth of nature, and became, I think, as great an emulator of it as anyone has ever been. In clothing, food, and the other matters of daily life he practiced, without any tragic pretension to grander pomp, the plainness and simplicity of a private citizen, but genuinely royal magnificence in those things where it was noble for the ruler to have the advantage. And these were self-mastery, endurance, temperance, and quickness of mind, understanding, knowledge, labors, hardships endured, contempt for pleasures, acts of justice, exhortations to what is best, blame and lawful punishment of wrongdoers, and again, praise and honors according to law for those who do right. And so, having bidden a hearty farewell to the accumulation of money and to wealth that inspires such pride among men, God rewards him by giving him in return the greatest and most perfect wealth of all. This is the wealth of the whole earth and sea and rivers and all the other elements and their compounds. For deeming him worthy to appear as a partner of his own portion, he released the whole cosmos to him as a possession fitting for an heir. And so each element obeyed him as its master, changing the power it had and yielding to his commands. Nor is this perhaps surprising, for if, according to the proverb, what belongs to friends is held in common, and the prophet has been called a friend of God, cf. Exodus 33:11, then it would follow that he shares also in God's possessions, so far as that is useful. For God, possessing everything, needs nothing, while the good man, though he possesses nothing in the strict sense, not even himself, nevertheless partakes, so far as he is able, of the treasures of God. And this is perhaps fitting, for he is a citizen of the world, for which reason he was not enrolled as a citizen of any one of the cities of the inhabited earth, since he had received, as was proper, not a portion of a country but the whole cosmos as his portion. What then? Did he not also enjoy an even greater partnership, being deemed worthy of the very same title as the Father and Maker of all things?